And thank you guys for coming out. I know it's a chilly evening for you, and I know there are many things you could be doing on a Monday evening. The fact that you are in this room tonight, I want you to know that you're my heroes. The fact that you're dedicating time out of your life for this event, my hat's off to you. I want to make you three promises tonight before we go anywhere. Number one, I will never, none of us this week will ever once ask for any money from you. All right, promise number. How many have ever been to a religious event where you found out what they really wanted was just your money? How many have ever been through that scenario? Yeah, we'll never ask for your money this week. Number two, at no point, and this will become more clear, this will be confusing at first, but it'll become more clear as we progress through this evening. At no point during the entire week will I ever ask you to embrace the religion of Christianity. That's not what this is about. I know it's in a church, but that's not what this is about. Promise number three, I promise you that what we're going to look at over the next 5 nights, we're going to give an intellectually honest, honest intellectually. We're not after certitude. We're after being honest with the questions that exist. An intellectually honest, a culturally relevant, and a relationally respectful. How many of you have ever known religious people that just like to just blow people's relationships up? How many of you have ever bumped into that before? Where, yeah. It's going to be intellectually honest, culturally relevant, and a relationally respectful look at the ethical teachings of Jesus. And let me explain to you what I mean by that. Today, when we talk about Jesus, there's one of three approaches. The first one is more of an ontological approach, is what scholars call it. In other words, they try through philosophy and logic and reason to prove the existence of God. How many have ever gone through discourses like that where you've, yes, yes, that's not what this week is. Number two, and I've done the second one, this is not a look at the evidence for the historical reliability of the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I'm not going to prove that those historically took place. What I'm doing this week instead, I want us to take a look at the actual ethical teachings of Jesus and ask if there's any relevance in those teachings for our lives today in the 21st century. Let me explain it this way. For those of you who are Christians, do not become unnerved by what I'm about to say. Think of, for the moment, the story of Cinderella. How many know what story I'm talking about? Nobody tries to prove that that Cinderella is a historical story. Are you with me? We all know that it's fairy tale. If you know that, say yes. But are there truths, are there story truths in the Cinderella story that we can glean from? Those of you who are Christians, I'm not implying that your Jesus story is nothing more than the Cinderella story. All I'm asking is, wherever you are on the spectrum tonight, whether you believe it actually happened in history or you're not sure whether it happened in history or not, there are story truths in the Jesus story that we can glean out of that story. Are you with me? And that's what I'm asking us to do this week. Let's just stop and look at what the story truths are of the Jesus story. We have four versions of them. We have what's called Matthew's, Mark's, Luke's, and John's. And they're all four different versions. Three of them are very similar, but four different versions of the Jesus story. And whether it's true or not, whether it's historical or not, we can all agree, if some of you have to look at it like a fairy tale that has a good point, do that. If some of you, that sends you through the toolies, then believe it actually happened. But whichever, wherever you are on that spectrum, over here, or somewhere in between, I'm just glad you're here. Are you with me? I'm just glad you're present tonight. And we can all just, wherever we're at on that spectrum, say, what's the story truth? What's the story truth in the, if there is any? So we're going to pick up. I am convinced that in the fourth century, the reason I'm not going to ask you to embrace the religion of Christianity is because I believe in the fourth century, the Christian religion went through a radical shift. It's what scholars call the Constantinian shift, where empire and religion became united. And we won't look at that much tonight. We might look at it later this week. But during that event, the ethical teachings of Jesus were significantly marginalized. For the last 1700 years, Christianity has been very good about talking about story details. In other words, a virgin birth, a crucifixion, a resurrection. But Christianity is very slow to actually take seriously the ethical teachings of Jesus. How many have noticed that, by the way? I'm not telling you anything new. I find it ironic that back in the States, one of my heroes, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., how many know that name? Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who was a Baptist minister in the Bible Belt, the region of America that we call the Bible Belt, had to go to India to learn about the Sermon on the Mount from a little brown Hindu man named Gandhi. How many find that ironic? Because the ethical teachings of Jesus had been significantly marginalized by colonial Christianity. How many would agree with that? Gandhi began reading the Sermon on the Mount and he started taking the ethical teachings of Jesus more seriously than the Christians were. They would ask him, "To what do you attribute your success?" Do you know what Gandhi would say? He said, "I have spent as long as I can remember spending 2 hours every day meditating on Jesus' Sermon on the Mount." How many find that ironic? They would ask him, "Gandhi, will you become a Christian?" He said, "I will when I find one." What did he mean by that? He wasn't trying to be insulting. He was saying, "You're wanting me to become like you. When you take Jesus' ethical teachings as seriously as I have, then I'll become like you. Until then, you need to become more like me." That's what he was saying. You see, Lord Irwin, it said, asked Gandhi one day in his office, "Gandhi, what do you think is going to solve the problems between the British Empire and your country of India?" The story says that Gandhi reached over, picked up a New Testament, opened it to Matthew 5, and he said, when my country and yours can come to terms with what this man taught in this sermon, he said, we will not only solve the problems between our two countries, we will have solved the problems of the entire world. For Gandhi, it wasn't about getting to heaven or escaping hell. It was about Jesus' kingdom coming on earth as it is in heaven and radically changing the world we live in. Today, Christianity is much more an escapist religion where it's all about, I've got a mansion over the hilltop. Very rarely do we ever see Jesus going around, and I'm just going to throw some things out there. Don't get upset. Come back tomorrow night. By the way, let me just say this. In the Jesus story, who had the hardest time with Jesus? The religious people or the non-religious people? So if you're non-religious, man, you're on easy street this week. Those of you who thought you showed up tonight to a religious event, thinking that Jesus is just going to pat you on the back and say, "You've got it all right." There's some things you've got right. But we're going to be challenged by some other things this week. We never see Jesus going around trying to get people to say a special prayer so they can go to heaven when they die. We do see Jesus going around trying to bring heaven into people's lives today. And that's a radical difference. So what I'm suggesting is that we take a look at these ethical teachings of Jesus that have been marginalized even by Christianity. G.K. Chesterton, how many know that name? G.K. Chesterton states that the history of Christianity, I was doing a series of presentations at Princeton University a couple years ago now, and a friend of mine, now a friend, came up to me after one of my presentations. He's an agnostic. And he said, "How can you say the teachings of Jesus have any relevance? Don't you see what the teachings of Jesus have produced historically?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he gave me the lengthy history of the Crusades. G.K. Chesterton would say, the history of Christianity does not prove that the teachings of Jesus have been tried and found wanting. The history of Christianity proves that the teachings of Jesus have been found hard and left untried. That's what I'm asking us to look at this evening. Each night we're going to take a look at the ethical teachings of Jesus. We're not going to try to prove His divinity. By the way, how many of the Gospels, we've got four of them, how many of them, by the way, the term Gospel just simply means story. It's the Jesus story. We're going to talk about Gospel a little bit next week, how it was used by Jesus and the apostles. It's a little bit different than how it's used today, but we're going to look at that next weekend. Regardless, within the four Gospels, how many of the Gospels even talk about the virgin birth? Do you know? Only two. Only two. You have two stories that don't even mention it. What does that mean for the authors of those two Jesus stories? That means that Mark and John thought you could learn about Jesus, become a follower of Jesus, and not even know about the virgin birth. How many find that puzzling? But guess what all four of the Gospels do have? The ethical teachings of Jesus. I want to be very clear because, and I see it even in the room tonight, and I don't want to pick on anybody, I just want to make this obvious. I just want us to see it. Today, well, no. Back up. Fourth century, Constantinian Christianity, when empire and Christianity became united and everybody overnight became Christian. Christianity went from a persecuted minority to a persecuting majority. Before Constantine, what defined someone as a Christian is someone who is endeavoring to try and follow the ethical teachings of Jesus. When those ethical teachings became thrown out, what defined a person whether they were Christian or not is whether they believed in story details. Do you believe in the virgin birth? Do you believe in the crucifixion? Do you believe in the resurrection? By the way, today, and that's what I was going to say a minute ago, today, neo-atheism, what's their tack? How are they trying to disprove Christianity? By calling into question the credibility of story details. What if it's not believing in story details that makes someone a follower of Jesus or not? As I just said, how many Gospels have the story detail of the virgin birth? What if it has always been about not necessarily just believing in Jesus, but actually following Jesus as well? What does that look like? Okay, we're going to get into it. What does it look like? Let's jump right into Luke 4. We're going to begin right where Jesus does in Luke's version of this story. In the Jesus story, it says He went to Nazareth. Take your handouts with me. He went to Nazareth where He'd been brought up. And on the Sabbath day, He went into their synagogue, as was His custom. This is the beginning of the Gospel of Luke. As Luke progresses, what you'll find is that Jesus is banned from preaching in the synagogue. So this is the beginning. He's still preaching in the synagogues. He's not in the open air yet. It says, He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to Him. Now bear with me. This will make sense in just a moment. Unrolling it, He found the place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because He has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, to set the oppressed free, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Now, what is He meaning by this? All human societies are set up in a pyramid structure. Where are the most amount of people in a pyramid structure? At the bottom. Where are the least amount of people? And whose benefit is the pyramid structured to benefit? The few at the top. The few at the top benefit off of all the ones at the bottom. And you let just a few, just as many up that process from the bottom as is enough to keep those at the bottom believing that it's possible to actually get to the top. But there's not room at the top for everybody. Are you with me? But it's important we don't discover that, or else the whole thing won't work. Jesus comes and He says, "I've come to proclaim good news to which side of the pyramid?" The bottom. Jesus came to flip the world upside down, or I think right side up again. But if you're being benefited, you think it's all being turned upside down. But this is what Jesus is proclaiming. The Jews were at which part of the pyramid in relation to the Roman Empire? The bottom. They were captives of the Roman Empire. And he says, then he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, sat down, and the eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on him. Bear with me. And he began saying to them, today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. All spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips. And they said, is not this Joseph's son? Let me unpack this a little bit. He's just read from the scroll of Isaiah. He says, I've come to proclaim good news to everybody on which side of the pyramid? On the bottom. What are they thinking right now? What do they think? Yeah! And then they say, and then he says, and today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing. And they're like getting even more excited. And they're speaking well of him. And they're saying, man, isn't this Joseph's son? Isn't he one of our hometown boys? Wow, finally Nazareth is going to get put on the map for something good. He's one of us. And they're all excited because they misunderstood what Jesus said so far. Let's back up. Jesus actually misquotes Isaiah. He doesn't read what's written. Let me go back to Isaiah and share with you. In Isaiah 61, 1 through 2, it says, the Spirit of the Sovereign, it's in the grace section, the Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me because the Lord has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor, sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, proclaim freedom for the captives, release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God. Which part did Jesus leave off? The vengeful God part. What Jesus is virtually saying here is that I'm going to be traversing the countryside proclaiming just the favor of God. I'm going to be leaving off all of that vengeful God stuff. Pause to think about that for a moment. Do we find that true in the Jesus story? Those of you who are familiar with it. Do you ever find in the Old Testament some vengeful pictures of God that you find disconcerting when you come to Jesus? There seems to be some disharmony between the two. How many have ever been caught in that tension before? You know what I'm talking about. Jesus actually is intentionally producing that tension. It's not by accident. He's saying, I'm just coming to proclaim God's favor. I'm going to be leaving off all the vengeful God stuff. And we see that in the Jesus story. Jesus does not portray a vengeful God, does he? He portrays a God who has favor on how many? Everybody. Everybody Jesus meets. He bestows his favor on them. And that's actually why he got in trouble, is he didn't make a distinction between whom God favors and whom God doesn't. And that made those who got their identity from being favored by God when other people weren't, it made those people very uncomfortable, very upset. But the Jews weren't catching this at this point. What did this passage mean to... This was a famous passage to the Jews. In the Hebrew culture, what did this passage mean? It meant that when Messiah would come, the hope of the Hebrew people, and I hope we have enough time to get through all this tonight, but the hope of the Hebrew people was not to one day become a disembodied soul in some far-off distant bliss. The hope of the Hebrew people was that one day Messiah would come and Messiah would not whisk us away to somewhere else. Messiah would put right all the injustice, oppression, and violence on planet Earth. That's what they were looking for. Messiah would come and he would restore Israel. And Israel would be at the center of this restored world. But they had this hope that it would be God's favor on them and God's vengeance on who? Talk to me now. I got to get you out of here tonight. Talk to me. Vengeance on who? On everyone else. Are you with me? Favor on us, vengeance on them. And this passage in Isaiah was memorized by them so that it's like this. If I say up, what word comes to mind? If I say peanut butter, what word comes to mind? Thank you for saying jelly. The last place said mayonnaise. I don't know either. That's just disgusting. If I say Batman, who do you think of? If I say hot, what do you think of? If I say New Zealand, what do you think of? Kiwi. All right, good. We all have word associations, all right? We all have word. Whenever they heard the year of God's favor, you didn't need to finish it. In their headspace, they heard, and the year of God's vengeance. They were connected. They were two sides of the same coin. So when Jesus says, I've come to proclaim the year of God's favor, everybody of the room said, and vengeance. Even though Jesus didn't. And vengeance. And then he said, and today this prophecy is fulfilled in your hearing. And they're thinking, woohoo! Finally, God's showing up. He's going to forgive me. Start taking names and kicking tail. Our deliverance has come. Before we unpack that, let's look at this favor of God and leaving off the vengeful God stuff. I find great comfort in this. I've been doing this for about 20 years now. And over those 20 years, I've gotten a lot of emails. And in those emails, many people are concerned. They'll say, Herb, we feel like you're a little imbalanced. And I'll always write back, well, help me. I am imbalanced, by the way. We all are. Do you realize that? We're all imbalanced. But what imbalance are you wanting me to focus on? What are you wanting to fix? And this is what I've gotten repeatedly over the years. Herb, we feel like you focus too much on God's favor. We never hear from you about God's vengeance. That used to concern me until I read Luke 4, and I saw Jesus doing the same thing. How do we see this play out? See if I'm right. Look at Luke 19, 5 through 7. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today. So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. And all the people saw this and began to mutter, he's gone to be the guest of a what? Now, very quickly, sinner in this story, in this cultural context, tonight is a crash course. We're getting a crash course in the cultural context in which Jesus gave his ethical teachings. In this cultural context, the word sinner does not mean the same thing that Christians mean when they use the word sinner. The Hebrews use the term sinner very differently. Today, when Christians say sinner, they at least, regardless of how it's been abused, tangent, we don't have time for tangents. We at least say we believe that everybody's a sinner, including us. Am I right? It's a universal, everybody's a sinner. In Jesus' day, the term sinner was not universal. You see, the Hebrew community was a community to which certain promises had been made. Scholars call those the covenants. And you didn't earn a place in that community by following the teachings of Moses. You demonstrated that you wanted to be a part of this community to whom the promises had been made by following the teachings of Moses. You didn't earn it. You were just stating, I want to be a part of this group by trying to follow these teachings of Moses. A Jew was born into this community by birth, but they still had a choice to remain in that community or to jettison out of it. If a Jew wanted to remain, they would follow the teachings of Moses. If they did not want to claim their heritage and the covenants and the promises, they did not follow the teachings of Moses. They did not follow Torah. That's the word for law. They lived lives contrary to the Torah, the first five books of the Old Testament, the law, the teachings of Moses. Jews, they never called Gentiles this. Jews who were not living according to Torah, do you know what they called them? Sinners. Are you with me? Not universal. Sinner meant a Jew who was not living according to the law. Got it? Would Zacchaeus have fit that profile? He was a tax collector working for the Romans. He was a Jew, and yet he was in partnership with the Roman Empire, who was plundering. So they would have labeled him as someone who's rejecting his position in the community. He's taking sides with the enemy. He is a sinner. Zacchaeus is up in a tree. Do the math. Why would a little short guy in a three-piece suit, because he's wealthy, be up in the top of a tree to see Jesus? Well, he's heard something about Jesus and wants to see him, but he's, and I understand this, he's vertically challenged. Are you with me? I get that. He's not tall. The parade's coming by. Where do short people show up when the parade's going by? Where do they stand? On their tiptoes? Maybe. Okay, family picture is taken. What do we say? Short people where? On the front. That's right. When there's a parade going by, short people don't climb trees. They get to the front. They stand on the curb, right? Why was Zacchaeus not on the curb? Why was he up in the tree? Because he tried to get to the curb, but every time he stepped this way, two people would move together. And then he'd go this way and they'd move together again. Are you with me? What were they doing? They were shunning him. So he knows the parade route. He runs on ahead. He climbs a tree, gets himself a good spot. And Jesus walks up and says, "What on earth is that guy doing up in a tree?" He says, "Whatever it is going on in your heart that would make you climb that tree dressed like that to see me, I got to find out more about. Get down here. We're going to your house for lunch today." That's what he's saying. I want to find out your story. I want to find out more about you. And then they start to grumble. "Oh, he's gone to have lunch at the house of a sinner." And put yourself in Zacchaeus' shoes. Have you ever met someone and your first impressions, they're important, aren't they? You want to come across good to someone upon first meeting, don't you? Well, he's running the risk right now. He's wanting to meet Jesus, and he's wanting Jesus to have a good impression of him, and they're blowing his cover. Are you with me? They're letting it out of the bag what he is when he's not ready to reveal it yet. They're airing his dirty laundry. And if you're Zacchaeus, you're in that moment thinking, he's about to find out what I really am. And he's going to change his mind. And you got to imagine Jesus reaching behind him. He doesn't even look at Zacchaeus. He just squeezes Zacchaeus' shoulder. And he keeps his eye on the crowd. He squeezes it in an affirming way, as if to say, "I've got this." You got to imagine, this is the gospel according to Herb, okay? You got to imagine Jesus looking at them and saying, "The only thing I care about is whether or not his wife makes good lamb chops." And they go off to lunch. And over a bowl of hummus, Zacchaeus becomes overwhelmed, not with a vengeful God, but with a God who has favor on him, even though he's a sinner. And he stands up in the middle of that lunch and he says, "Half of everything I have, I'm going to give back to the poor. And if I've stolen anything from anybody, I'm going to give four times back." Moses only commands 20%. He's giving 400%. Jesus says that day in front of everyone, "Today salvation has come to this house." Because salvation is not freedom from a penalty. It's being healed from a sickness. He says, "Today salvation has come to this house, for this man is a child of Abraham too." What was Jesus showing that day? Favor or vengeance? And did it bring healing to Zacchaeus' soul? Yeah. I'm going to be proclaiming the year of God's favor, period. I'm going to be leaving off all that vengeful stuff. We come to Matthew 9. He was at dinner at Matthew's house. This is not just one tax collector. This is getting worse. Jesus has let a tax collector be one of the 12, one of his 12 disciples. and he's at a party that Matthew threw. Well, back in that culture, who you ate with was your tribe. The people you ate with were the people that were like you. And so if he's having a dinner at his house for Jesus, who's showing up? All the other tax collectors. You got to imagine Jesus hanging out at a party with tax collectors and prostitutes. He's sitting across the table having a discussion with a young lady named Ginger while she's sipping on her wine. The Pharisees would have had to have jumped through many hurdles to even show up at a party like that. Are you with me? Jesus just goes and hangs out. And what's he showing them the whole time? Favor. And how do the people respond? The Pharisees saw this and they asked the disciples, why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners? Luke 7:39, when the Pharisees who invited him saw this, he said to himself, if this man were a prophet, he would know who it is who's touching him, what kind of woman she is, that she is a what? What was Jesus showing all of this? Whom? What did the Pharisees say these people deserved? Vengeance. They needed a good, healthy dose of the vengeance of God because look how they're living. And Jesus chose not to show them vengeance. He chose to show them what? And did it change their lives? Yeah. Look at it in Luke 15. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. Oh. They were drawn to him. The Pharisees had a kind of holiness that repelled sinners. They steered clear of the Pharisees. Maybe this is too hard of a question to ask on night number one. Jesus had a kind of holiness that attracted sinners. My question to you is today, are sinners being strangely attracted to churches? Or are they steering clear for fear of being judged and once judged, condemned? We have to allow this to confront us. Because depending upon that answer, to the degree that people are steering clear from us rather than being attracted to us, to that same degree, it is indicative that we have quite possibly imbibed more the spirit of the Pharisees than we have the Spirit of Christ. Jesus says, I've come to proclaim the favor of God. On how many? I'm going to be leaving off all that vengeful God stuff. There's more there for you to read. For the sake of time, let's go back to Luke 4. Jesus walked the earth as the radical, extravagant, and what the religious people labeled as dangerous favor of God. He practiced a boundary-pushing, Torah law-challenging, line-crossing, Pharisee-infuriating table practice. What do I mean by table practice? Back then, whom you ate with was your tribe, your people. Whom did Jesus eat with? Sinners. He ate with Pharisees too, but he ate with everybody is the point. He came to proclaim just God's favor on how many? On everyone. Do you see it? Some people think Luke had an eating disorder. Because if you read the Gospel of Luke, Luke's version of the Jesus story, Jesus is just going from one table to the next. It's one meal after another. And people say, what? Was Luke addicted to food? I mean, what's the deal? What scholars realize now is that Luke had a point to make. That back then in that culture, who you sat at table with said volumes. And Jesus sat at table with people whom the Pharisees, the religious leaders of his day, said should not be invited to the table. Religion, this is why I make a distinction between the religion about Jesus and Jesus himself. It's about a person, not a religion. Religion says clean up your act first, then you can have a place at the table. Jesus just asks if you're hungry. And he pulls up a chair and he says, here, come sit beside me. Get in my spot. And you say, but you don't know about it. He says, don't worry about that. We'll take care of that later. You're hungry. Just come get something to eat. How many are thankful for a Jesus that looks like that? And what if God looks like Jesus? That's the million-dollar question. What if God looks like Jesus? That blows a hole in a whole bunch of religion, does it not? Let's be honest. Because religion has made a business out of determining upon who deserves God's favor and who deserves God's vengeance. And you start going around saying God looks like Jesus, be careful, they'll crucify you too. Let's get back to Luke 4 before I get in trouble. Jesus said to them, here's my version. You guys are all, remember Luke 4, he just said, just favor, and they're saying, woo-hoo-hoo! Isn't this Joseph's son? This is hometown boy. Because remember when he said God's favor, what did they say in their head? And vengeance. That's right. Even though did Jesus say that? That was just inside their headspace where they heard that. Jesus virtually says once again, you don't have a sweet clue what it is I'm talking about. He says, Jesus said to them, surely you will quote this proverb to me, physician, heal yourself. And you will tell me, do here in your hometown what we have heard that you do in Capernaum. For the sake of space, all he's doing here is saying, you're going to reject me before this is all said and done. Truly, I tell you, he continued, prophets are not accepted in their hometown. Now watch closely. He says, I assure you, there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time. And when the sky was shut up for 3.5 years, and there was a severe famine throughout the land, yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to the widow in Zarephath in the region of Sidon. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet, yet not one of them was cleansed, only Naaman the Syrian. Now circle these two. If you have a way to write tonight, if you have a pencil or a pen, by the way, if you don't have one, it would be a stellar idea to bring one tomorrow night. Some type of writing utensil. Tonight, prick your finger, maybe that'll work. But circle, just kidding, don't do that. Circle Sidon and Syria. Why is Jesus dropping these two stories? It's not about Elijah and Elisha. He's using a story, he's using two stories in their Hebrew narrative, stories that mean something to them. Because Elijah and Elisha have connections to a certain region. Let me take you back through some Jewish history in the short time. We had a late start. I'm going to try to get you out of here in the next 7 minutes. Are you still okay? Can I have 7 more minutes? You're doing it? You're all right? Okay, good, 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 good. This will be worth the price of admission right here. You can do the math later. It was free. But it's worth the price right here. 200 years previous to this day in the synagogue, a division of the Greek Empire called the Seleucid Empire had endeavored to wreak a holocaust against the Jewish people. It was spearheaded by their leader, Antiochus Epiphanes. How many have ever read the Apocrypha, the intertestamental books? A couple of you have. Antiochus Epiphanes led the Seleucid Empire in a holocaust against the Hebrew people, and what was produced from that in Jewish history was called the Maccabean Revolt. How many have ever heard that term before? Matthias was the father. He had two sons, Maccabees. This is the Maccabee family. When Matthias was dying, his dying words were, remember the law of our God and wreak vengeance on our enemies. What on our enemies? Vengeance. One of his sons, Judah, took that so seriously that when he led the Hebrew people in militaristic warfare against the Seleucids, he earned the nickname, does anyone know what Judah's nickname was? The Hammer. That's what it was. That's how he'd come down on the Greeks. By the way, this is the kind of Messiah Israel was looking for to show up to deliver them from Rome. Someone who would lead them with militaristic violence against the Roman Empire like the Hammer had and liberate them.
We'll talk about that tomorrow night. Jesus was not that. He was many things, but he was not that. He had not come to proclaim favor on you, vengeance on them. He drops these two terms, Sidon and Syria. Do you know why? Do you know what the capital of the Seleucid Empire was? Sidon. Do you know what the Roman Empire called the Seleucid Empire? Syria. When Jesus drops Sidon and Syria, what he's saying is, I've come to proclaim the year of God's favor, not just on you, but the year of God's favor on those Seleucids too. You see, that would be the equivalent. Next month in America, there's a holiday coming up called July 4th, where Americans celebrate a revolution against the British Empire that did not look like Gandhi's. It was a bloody revolution. And they'll celebrate it on that day and how victorious America is. And I want you to imagine that I'm invited to a militaristic celebration, a military celebration over in America. I don't know if I'd go or not, but I would be invited, let's say. And I gave this thrilling discourse on the history of America. And at the end of it, I mean, everyone's on beta, and the Star-Spangled Banner begins playing, and the flag begins waving, and all of these vets and all of these military personnel are all in the audience. And at the end, I say, "And God bless America!" And what do you think would happen in the room? Oh, they'd say, on their feet. You know how violent America is. Our gift to the world is not democracy. It is war. They would, yes! And then if I were to say, and God bless Al-Qaeda too! Do you get what would happen? This is not even close to what Jesus is doing here. Jesus is saying, yes, I've come to proclaim God's favor on you, but I've come to proclaim God's favor on your enemies too. And you're going to have to learn how to love even your enemies. And we struggle with this because we still want to just blow them away. Oh, you thought this was going to be a sermon on how God favors you, didn't you? You are all getting into it. I saw you guys about 20 minutes ago. Oh, yes, God's so good. Thank you for loving me, God. Everybody loves the God loves you message. Nobody loves the God loves your enemies that you hate too. In other words, people like the idea of loving your enemies until you start defining who those enemies really are. We do it in our social relationships, sociologically. If you and I are friends, don't you get miffed if I start being friends with someone who has ill-treated you? Don't you think, well, why are you being friends with them? Don't you know what they did to me? Do you get it? This is what Jesus is doing right here. He's saying, I've come to proclaim God's favor on you, yes, but just God's favor, no vengeance, God's favor on how many? Everyone! And what was the response then? Woo-hoo-hoo! Hometown boy! What does it say? It says all the people in the synagogue were what? Furious. How furious? It says when they heard this, they got up, drove him out to the town, took him to the brow of the hill in which the town was built in order to throw him off a cliff. How furious? Homicidal rage. By the way, if you've never been tempted as a religious person or a patriotic person or a tribal person, if you've never been tempted to throw Jesus off the cliff, you've probably not met the right Jesus yet. How many can identify with what was happening in that synagogue that day? Why they got so upset? You can see it. Jesus tells the story. When the Pharisees were upset at Jesus showing God's favor on these sinners that they thought should be the recipients of vengeance, not favor. Jesus told the story of a father who had two sons. One son chose to take his inheritance early and go out and blow it on wine, women, and song. How many know the story of the prodigal son? Of course you do. It is the most famous story that Jesus ever told. Everybody, if they know any story, they know that one. We love that story because which character do we identify most with in the story? Talk to me. The prodigal son. We want to be the one who shows up on the horizon and God gets up off the front porch and just starts sprinting towards us when he sees our form and the silhouette of our form in the sun. Don't we? We love that part of the story, don't we? But was Jesus telling that story because there were prodigals he was trying to reach that day? Was he trying to do a good old Baptist altar call? Forgive me, we got more Baptists than we got people where I come from. Was he trying to just make a good old, oh, you'll get it later, a good old altar call? No, the point of the story is about the older brother, isn't it? The older brother knew his father loved him, didn't he? The older brother did not have a hard time believing the father loved him. He comes home that night. And he sees the party, he sees the lights on. He asks the servant what's going on. The servant tells him. And he gets furious. How mad? Here we are again, aren't we? Favor on me, but favor on him too. Do you see it? And the father comes out to plead with him. And I love the dialogue between the two. The brother says, that son of yours. And the father says, no, that brother of yours. And the story just ends. There's no conclusion. Because the older brother is left in outer darkness that night with the father pleading with him to come in. But notice who's on the inside, who's on the outside. If this story tells us anything, it is screaming to us that if any are left in outer darkness in the end, it will not be because you could not accept God's love for you. The older brother had no problem accepting God's the Father's love for him. If any are lost at last, it will not be because they could not accept God's love for them. It'll be because they could not accept God's inclusion of someone they thought should be excluded. Ponder that. That's heavy, isn't it? One last parable, and then I got to get you out of here. How many know the parable? We don't have time to read it all. It's there, Matthew 22. It's in your handout. You can read for homework. I remember the parable of the wedding feast where the ones that were originally invited said no, and so then he went out and he gathered everybody that possibly could to come in. It was ollie, ollie, in free. It wasn't that he lowered the standard, he obliterated the standard. He just said, everybody come in, everybody in. I just want my house full. Everybody in. When they showed up, he started giving them out garments. Because what did garments do? Remember, they were poor, blind, crippled, lame. They were morally inferior. These were the sinners, along with everybody. This is the good and the bad, the story says. They both get herded into the room. And who chooses not to wear the garment? The bad people? Think about it. It's not the bad. The bad person, the poor person walks up and sees this nice garment. What are they going to do? Look at these threads, Martha. They're going to put them on. Like a rooster. Strutting, that's the word. They're going to be strutting it. Look at this. Who's the person that's going to have a hard time wearing the same thing that everyone else is in the room? Are you hearing me? The guy comes in, the host, and he sees one of the people there reject not wearing the garment. Here's my question. Think about it before you answer it. Is the guy rejecting an article of clothing? Or is he rejecting being identified with everyone else in the room as well? Do you hear what I'm saying? When he puts that on, in that moment, he's saying there's no difference between me and them And he's protesting. Do you see it? He's saying, I'm not going to wear this if everybody else is. I know this intimately because I hate name tags. Hate them. The ones that you wear around the neck, that's doable. But the ones they peel off and stick on you, those things are horrible. Anybody here hate name tags? I'm invited to events to speak all the time, and they'll give me a name tag. Here, wear this. To this day, I've never worn one. I just won't do it. And you know why? Because I have something broken inside of me that always has to be different. If everyone else is doing it, I can't do it. I just can't. That is a window into what's going on in this man's heart, but it's moral. This man is saying both good and bad are in this room. He has no problem with him being there. Are you with me? He's so smug and so sure that he belongs there. It's the other people in the room that he doesn't want to participate with their presence. And so he refuses to go along with the show. He's the older brother in that moment. Do you see that? And what does the host do? Takes him and throws him into outer darkness. It's Jonah. When the Ninevites repented, Jonah got ticked off. He said, I knew this would happen. I knew if I came and preached, they'd repent, and I knew you were nice. That's what he said. What Jonah is virtually saying, forgive me, is if I got to live in the same world with those Ninevites now, I'll be damned. He said, I'd rather die. Kill me now, he says. I'd rather be dead than be alive alongside of them. Do you see what Jonah's going through? And he was a prophet. It's the older brother all over again. Don't misunderstand me. How many of you, no, I won't ask for a raise of hands, but maybe there are some of you who came tonight who you've never been good at playing the religious game. When you hang out with religious people, you can't help feeling like you're an outsider. Like you don't fit in. Like you don't belong. These stories that Jesus told, historically accurate or not, I don't care tonight. The story truth is that if there is a God, and if that God does look like that guy who told these kinds of stories, you're who the kingdom was made for. He's come to proclaim the year of God's favor to those that have been made feel. And for those of you who are so sure that you're on the inside and others aren't, it's the others aren't part that we need to be very leery of. Be very careful when you start making distinctions, because aren't we all children of God? Aren't we all children of the same divine parents? Don't we all come from God originally, according to the Hebrew narratives? Aren't we all siblings? And think about it. Does God love all of us? Did Jesus come to create a new world for all of us? Then we need to be very careful whom we set up to say who belongs in that world and who doesn't. Because in that moment, it may not be them that we're excluding. In the effort to exclude them, it's we ourselves that are shut out. Because God will not become like us in our exclusivity. He's asking us to become like Him in His inclusivity. Powerful. How many saw some things in some parables tonight that you hadn't seen before? You've got some new meaning to some of those. This is what we're looking at. The first ethical teaching of Jesus that he taught was inclusivity versus exclusivity. The religious folks in the room are going to have the hardest time with that. And I'm not picking on you. I'm just saying, welcome to the Jesus story. Who was it who had a hard time with Jesus back then? Those who were on the outside or those who were sure they were on the in? Because now you're letting everybody in, Jesus. Don't you know we have new carpet around here? You know, so to speak. The first ethical teaching of Jesus was inclusivity. How many think
that that might hold some relevance to our world today. We're so tribal, aren't we? We're so national. We're so divided. Jesus is trying to reunite us as a family. And the question is, not will everyone be there? The question is, if someone isn't, why? It won't be for the reasons we might have assumed. And it may not be the ones we've assumed will be where. It may be radically different than what we've thought. First ethical teaching is radical inclusivity. For those of you who are followers of Jesus, Jesus walked the earth as the radical, extravagant, and dangerous. How many feel like, let's be honest, let's just be honest. I don't want to pretend, let's be honest. How many feel like what I've shared tonight is dangerous? Be honest. Welcome to the Jesus story. That's exactly what the Pharisees felt too. Welcome to the, you've just stepped, you're in the right story, in other words. We're interpreting it correctly if we're responding the same way they did in the story. Jesus walked the earth as the radical, extravagant, and dangerous enemy-embracing favor of God. He practiced a boundary-pushing, Torah-challenging, line-crossing, Pharisee-infuriating, radical table practice. And the question we have to ask if we are followers of Jesus is, do we? It's not enough to believe in Jesus. We have to also believe in what he taught. Challenge, amen? How many are thankful for Jesus that looks like that, though? Really? We just need... And don't get me wrong, I think God loves everyone, amen? People get upset at me when I'm a little hard on America. I can do it because I'm from there. You guys do it and it's offensive. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. You won't offend me, trust me. But people say, well, Herb, don't you love America? Well, yeah, I do, but I just wonder, why should that love stop at the borders? Shouldn't it go all the way around? Shouldn't it include everyone? So, ethic number one, what is it? Inclusivity, that's right. And we're going to look at tomorrow night, we're going to look at what has changed the world when people have chose to put it into practice. Tomorrow night's teaching is Jesus' teaching called the Way of Peace. Jesus' radical peace teachings. If you have questions, I want you to write those down so you don't forget them. Bring them back tomorrow night, and we'll begin tomorrow night with questions from this evening. Thank you for being here. I'm going to hand it over to Ben and let him wrap it up. Thank you so much for having me. We're going to have a good week.